let me in. Shiba, shiba. I want to be closer to you. Shiba, shiba. Open up your soul. Shiba, shiba. Let me find that part of you, the part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your.
Hello and welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something, or when it's the first Monday of the month, understand something. You know how I love my scientists and how I love astronomy? And now they're paired together. Here to talk about the fabulousness of astronomy, I'd like to welcome, representing Wonderfest, Tyler Cox. Hi.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for being on the show today. So before we get into the subject of astronomy, tell me, when is the first time that you were bitten by the science bug?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So I, growing up, I think I had a lot of great teachers around me.
Mm-hmm.
So both my grandmothers actually were teachers. So they instilled a love of learning pretty early on. And both my parents actually went to school and had STEM majors, and had this agreement with me that, the only thing that was unlimited in terms of what I wanted were books. So if there was a book I was interested in having, they were willing to get it for me. So I, you know, spent a lot of time reading like books on marine biology, chemistry, but I think the one that stuck with me the most was astronomy. So from the time I was 10 on, I was extremely interested in astronomy. And it helped that my dad had a real big interest in astronomy growing up, too, after watching Cosmos. So,
I am so jealous of you, because I would have loved to have the agreement that any book that I wanted I could have as a kid. That just sounds like heaven. So,
it was the best deal.
Oh, yay. Now, since you say that both of your grandmoms were educators, was there ever like a healthy competition between them, or were they just like, oh, we love whatever, all of it is good?
Oh, no competition, because they taught different things. So my grandma on my dad's side, she taught English, and then on my mom's side, she taught like social studies. So there wasn't really too much competition, because they taught different subjects. So,
and how
I got a little bit of a love for those different subjects from them.
And how did, like, what did they do that made you love it? Because that's a skill.
I think the big thing was they always encouraged me to ask questions. So instead of dismissing me for asking, you know, questions that might have seemed silly, they were always happy to talk to me about whatever I wanted to talk about. So I think it was just the conversations that I had, and, you know, being able to ask questions without being discouraged, from asking things that might have seemed silly, was really helpful.
Well,
and they're also very encouraging to read and explore subjects. So, yeah.
Well, what, like, 'cause kids are, you know, they're sponges, but they don't know everything. So what would be considered a silly question, but that you really meant it?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I think when I was interested in astronomy, it was, you know, are all the planets habited? Like, is there life on every planet? Or, you know, does every, I don't know, it's hard to say exactly remembering back. But, I mean, there are definitely lots of questions about space that maybe seem silly. I don't know. Maybe looking back now, they seem silly, but at the time, they're probably normal questions for a kid.
Okay. So when you decided to pursue higher learning, was it a direct line to astronomy, or did you come by it sort of in a circuitous way?
It was pretty direct. So I think the one thing that really got me hooked on astronomy was actually my dad, because I remember pretty vividly we were, you know, driving home from a road trip at night. And I think he and I were really the only ones awake out of my family on this trip.
Mm-hmm.
And he noticed me looking out the window up at the sky, and essentially just told me that the stars that I was seeing may not be there today. And explained to me that it takes a long time for light from those stars to travel to reach our eyes. Mm-hmm. And in that time, those stars may have disappeared or exploded in these supernova explosions. And I thought he was messing with me at first, but when I, whenever I went to actually like look at it in my, you know, my astronomy books that I had and kind of confirm that what he said was true, it really blew my mind and just, I guess opened, you know, this, the universe to me, essentially, like understanding that, you know, there's a vastness to space for one. And then also that the sky itself can be a time machine of sorts. And I think from that point I was hooked on astronomy, and that's essentially all I wanted to do.
And how old were you when he blew your mind like that?
I was in middle school at the time, so probably 12, 13, in that range.
Okay.
And I, you know, we didn't have any astronomy classes at my high school, so I did most of the learning on my own. But yeah, I mean, that was essentially what I wanted to do from that point on. I just thought it was too cool to not do.
All right. And the heavy emphasis on math didn't discourage you?
No, I actually really enjoyed math. I think that came from another teacher of mine in third grade when we were doing these times tables. We, you know, went through our different sets of times. So you'd start with the ones and the twos and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And we do that every single day. And if you got the 12, then you got an ice cream from the principal's office. So I did that probably four or five times. So it's probably more my love of food that got me into math. But it sort of stuck, I guess. So, you know, if it works, it works.
It sounds like every educator in your life, from your parents to the teachers, all had cracked the code of how to engage you, either through food or fun or whatever.
They just found the right motivation. I really credit the educators in my life to getting me to where I am.
So fast forward now, you are studying astronomy, and from what I understand, you're studying like the creation of the first stars and galaxies?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. So now, you know, when you look in the universe, we see stars pretty much covering the entire sky.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, with bigger and better telescopes, we now look out into the universe and see that the universe is also covered with these galaxies, which are these massive collections of stars and planets.
Mm-hmm.
But what we don't have the best understanding of is how and when the first stars and galaxies actually formed. You know, the bigger and better telescopes that you build, the further back you can look into the universe. And as I sort of mentioned with that story with my dad, the further you look back into space, the further you're looking back into time. Greater distances equals more light, time for that light to travel, meaning that the further you look back, the further you're looking back into time as well. So building bigger and better telescopes actually allows you to look further back in time and sort of study when these first galaxies were forming and evolving. Except we have some trouble building bigger and better telescopes.
Sure.
Just from an engineering perspective, it's challenging to build big enough telescopes to look back to the very, very beginning when these first galaxies were forming.
Well, what's the biggest telescope thus far?
One of the biggest and most successful so far is what's called the James Webb Space Telescope.
Okay.
It's a telescope that actually just launched fairly recently. And it's the size of, it's roughly 6 meters in size, its main mirror is. And it's out in space beyond our atmosphere, so it makes these really crystal clear images, and it's finding some of the earliest galaxies that we know of.
So it's a telescope that's been launched into space?
That's right, yeah. It's outside of our Earth's atmosphere, mainly to reduce the impact that the atmosphere has on the light that it's trying to detect. So our atmosphere filters out a lot of the light that we actually want to see when we're trying to study these faraway galaxies. So launching a telescope outside of our atmosphere actually allows us the ability to observe those galaxies.
Okay, so you have this telescope that's out in space and it's looking far. How do you know, as scientists, how do you know that it's going? How do you know that there's not more to what the universe is than what the telescope can see?
That's a good question. Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of challenges to this for sure. Is you know, if you look out and find a galaxy, there's this confusion potentially between is that galaxy really far away and maybe big and massive and emitting a lot of light,
mm-hmm.
Or is it a close by galaxy that's not maybe emitting quite as much light? And there are techniques that we can use to get around this. One of those techniques is looking for specific emission lines, so
mm-hmm.
parts of the spectrum that emit more than others, that are detailed signs that we've found a galaxy at a certain distance away from us. So yeah, that's one way we do it. Another way is by building these models of galaxies.
Mm-hmm.
And by building these models, we can get some idea of what the spectrum of a galaxy might look like, and we can actually fit that spectrum to the emission that we've actually measured from these galaxies. And that allows us to understand about the properties of these galaxies. So things like how massive they are, how many stars they have, how much gas and dust they have, that sort of thing.
Now, when you talk about spectrums, are you talking about the color of the light that's coming out, or what does that refer to?
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Yeah. So the spectrum refers to the light that we're observing from these galaxies that's broken down into its component colors.
Mm-hmm.
So it's similar to if you took light, if you've ever seen light like pass through a prism.
Yes.
It breaks the light into its component colors. And if we have these really sensitive detectors, we can actually determine exactly how much of each color we have. Some of our more sensitive instruments just look at a few different colors.
Mm-hmm.
So it breaks the light into these really coarse bins, which then we can fit our galaxy models to. But the challenge of this is that a galaxy that's close by can mimic a galaxy that's far away if you just look at these few bins. So ideally, we want as many different colors as possible so that we can determine whether or not the galaxy is actually far away or close by.
So when you're determining, how does the color tell you? Is it like, oh, if it's red, it's this far away, and if it's blue, it's this far away? Is that how it works?
Yeah. So one of the interesting things about the universe is the fact that it's actually expanding. There's a lot of it's a useful process for us to help understand how far things are away. Because we know if there's a galaxy close by us, what its spectrum should roughly look like.
Mm-hmm.
And the expansion of the universe actually stretches out the light we see and moves it into the redder part of the spectrum. So a galaxy that normally would be blue close to us, if its light has passed through the universe as it expands, it tends to become redder. So typically what we do is we try to look for redder galaxies. Now, red galaxies aren't always a perfect indication that you found a galaxy that's far away, but it's a pretty good indication that you found a galaxy that's far away from us, and allows us to study those really early galaxies.
Okay. Hopefully I remember to come back to that, because I still have some questions, but I have a more pressing question, which is,
yeah, of course,
when you say that you're studying like the first stars and the first galaxies, how do you know that they're the first stars and the first galaxies versus just like random stars and random galaxies?
Sure. Yeah. I guess what I mean when I say that we're to study the first stars and galaxies, aren't necessarily interested in saying we want to find the very first star or the very first galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
But more to say that we know roughly what the galaxies nearby us look like. And we want a rough picture of what the very first stars and galaxies look like, whether or not they were big and massive and had a lot of young hot stars, or if, you know, how quickly they formed and evolved. So there are lots of things we understand about the general properties of the first stars and galaxies. Not so interested, in any one particular star galaxy, but rather what did they look like whenever they were first forming.
But what are the markers that tell you guys, this is, you know, one of the first stars, this is one of the first galaxies?
Oh, sure. Yeah, so I think this gets in line with what my project specifically is, which is one of the challenges to trying to detect these first stars and galaxies is one, the fact that they're extremely far away and you need to build these bigger and better telescopes to see them. The other is, in this early period of time, whenever these first stars and galaxies are forming, there's lots of free hydrogen gas that sits around these stars and galaxies.
Mm-hmm.
And that gas can actually absorb some of the emission from these galaxies. It's similarly to how if you're driving through, you know, say a foggy day,
mm-hmm.
At night, it's sometimes difficult to actually see the light that's coming from the stars that are coming towards you,
mm-hmm.
Or coming from the cars that are coming towards you, not stars. And in a similar way, this happens with the stars and galaxies that are being formed early on in the universe. Their emission is being blocked by the fog that's around them.
Which is the hydrogen gas?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, okay. The hydrogen gas itself is actually absorbing the emission from these stars and galaxies, making it difficult for us to actually detect them. So what my project is focusing on, and I guess this project that I'm involved with this wider collaboration, is instead of attempting to measure the emission from the stars and galaxies, what we're trying to do is measure the emission from the gas itself. So it would be like detecting the fog rather than actually looking for the stars and galaxies.
Okay.
And there are special tracers that you can look for in this fog to help determine when the first stars and galaxies started forming. Particularly things like the temperature of the fog.
Okay, so since you're using hydrogen as sort of the marker for when that star galaxy is created, does that mean if you're looking at the periodic table, the fog changes and moves up on the periodic table depending on when it was formed?
Not the element itself. So the fog is mostly just hydrogen,
okay.
Because hydrogen is the most abundant element in the universe. So rather than determining how the fog moves throughout the periodic table, it's more about how the fog itself changes in property. So how its temperature and density change over time. So we expect that these stars and galaxies, as they form, they're going to heat up the fog because of this hot emission that they're sending into it. So we can actually detect those tiny changes in temperature and density. And that should tell us what the properties of the first stars and galaxies are like.
So then what you're saying is really the only fogs that you find are hydrogen and not any other element on the periodic table.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So hydrogen is actually the element that we're building our instruments to detect.
Okay.
Yeah.
And when you're differentiating between the super old ones and the, just, you know, the not super old, not super young, but, you know, maybe medium sized, does that mean there's less fog around the newer galaxies and newer stars?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly right. So in the early universe, before there were really any stars and galaxies, this hydrogen gas was quite abundant. So there's lots of free hydrogen around, and it hadn't really been heated up by these stars mm-hmm. or galaxies just yet. But as you go further into the universe, you get more of these stars and galaxies forming, and they actually burn away the fog, in a sense.
Okay.
And that burning away makes it harder for us to detect its emission. So once you, if you can map away how this, map how this, this fog is being burned away by these hydrogen, by these stars and galaxies, that can give you some sense of how they're changing over time.
Okay. So, but the super old stars and the super old galaxies still have that fog around them.
That's correct. Yes.
Okay. And does that mean that it's just so cold that the gas doesn't get burned away?
That's right. Yeah, so once you have more of these galaxies that have formed, it makes it easier for the fog to be burned away, or ionized, as I guess the technical term for it.
Okay.
So yeah, once there are more galaxies present around this or in this fog, it makes it easier for them to work together to burn away the hydrogen.
Okay. So then in relation to our galaxy, and I know that the Earth sits sort of out in the boonies of our galaxy. Like,
mm-hmm.
how far away is the oldest, furthest galaxy that you guys have found?
Oh, that's a great question. So some of the furthest away galaxies were formed just about a billion years after the formation of the universe. So this was detected by the James Webb Space Telescope.
Uh-huh.
And that doesn't, I mean, it sounds like a long time, but it's actually fairly quick for a galaxy of the sizes that we're finding to be formed. So, we think they formed probably about 400 million years or so after the Big Bang. And we're having trouble detecting back to, about 400 million years or so.
Mm-hmm.
But we've certainly detected galaxies that were formed about a billion years after the Big Bang, we think.
Okay, so So you talk about the Big Bang, which is the, as I understand it, the explosion that brought the universe into being. Is that correct, or is that a wildly simplistic?
No, that's great. That's a great description. So I mentioned before that the universe is expanding, if you take this idea that the universe must be expanding now, that means it must have likely been smaller in its past.
Mm-hmm.
And if you keep reversing the clock about 14 billion years or so, we find that the universe was condensed into this one tiny point, we think probably the size of a proton, these tiny particles.
Okay.
And for some reason, we don't quite know the reason yet, there was this explosion or this expansion of that tiny infinitesimal point that led to the creation of all the matter that we see in the universe. For the first, say, 100 million years or so, there really wasn't much in the universe,
mm-hmm.
other than just hydrogen gas and helium gas. And it was about 100 million years or so after the Big Bang when those first stars and galaxies and the things that we are more familiar with started forming.
Okay. And so on those stars and galaxies that are farther away, do they have all the elements that are the building blocks of the universe? Like, we have that periodic table.
Yeah.
Do you suppose that all of the things that we find here on Earth in terms of, hydrogen, helium, blah, 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 blah,
mm-hmm.
do all of those exist in those galaxies? Or is that something that forms the further away you get from the Big Bang?
Yeah, that's a great question. Actually, we think there are only a few elements on the periodic table that were created by the Big Bang. So mostly hydrogen and helium; those are two of the most abundant elements that we have in the universe. And then trace amounts of lithium.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, what it takes to create the rest of the elements on the periodic table are stars, and it's one of the reasons why we're so interested in the formation of these stars, when they formed, how big they were, because it actually takes the stars fusing together these component elements, these hydrogen and helium atoms, into heavier elements, which are further down on the periodic table, and then explode to distribute those elements out for us to have the elements we need to create things like us and the elements that we have here on the Earth. That's one of the reasons that we're actually interested in studying these first stars, because back in the earliest stars and galaxies, there weren't much in the way of these heavy elements. There wasn't anything like carbon or oxygen. Until the very first stars formed, fused the material together to create those elements and then explode and distribute that material out into the galaxy.
So it sounds like you're saying that every time, no, not every time, but there are times when the stars explode and then there's a new element and then that new, like, I don't understand.
Maybe I'm not doing my best job explaining that process specifically. So these stars, how they work is they power themselves based on what's called fusion.
Okay.
So they take two elements, and most commonly it's hydrogen. So they'll take hydrogen,
mm-hmm.
And then fuse that together into something heavier.
Okay.
So they'll collide two hydrogen atoms really, really fast because mm-hmm. of the intense temperatures and pressures in the cores of these stars.
Okay.
And they'll end up forming, through some chain reaction, helium. And
okay.
then with helium, they can then collide two helium atoms together and form things like carbon and oxygen and nitrogen. So it's this stepwise process in which you're forming heavier and heavier elements by building up cores of things like helium and then carbon and oxygen. So it's these heavy stars that actually go through the process of first fusing hydrogen to helium and then helium into heavier and heavier elements. That actually builds up this core of heavy elements in the center of these massive stars. And then whenever these stars reach the end of their lives, they'll explode in this process called a supernova explosion that actually distributes the metals and the heavy elements out into the galaxy.
So, so if you go to, say, iron.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Or let's take something even lower on the table, like beryllium or something like that. So you've got hydrogen, you've got helium, you've got lithium or whatever it is. So the hydrogen's bumping into the hydrogen, and then it creates helium. Can
right.
the helium bump into now both helium or helium and hydrogen, or is it helium has to bump into helium?
It's, I mean, there are like smaller processes or more rare processes, I guess, where helium can bump into a hydrogen. But usually how it works is helium bumps in with helium.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is because when hydrogen bumps into hydrogen and starts forming these helium molecules, those will tend to sink to the center of the core, or I guess stay in the center of the core.
Uh-huh.
Because you're making this buildup of helium, and you actually need higher temperatures and higher densities to form these heavier elements to cause these helium atoms to collide with one another to form these heavy elements. You typically will mostly see fusion happen between helium. Okay. Because I guess there's a separation in the star where hydrogen mostly sits on the outside of the star, helium sits in the center of the star, and then as heavier and heavier elements are built up, they usually just sit in the core of the star.
Okay.
Almost like an onion is typically how it's drawn, with these different elements sitting at different layers in the star.
So then hydrogen begat helium, which begat and lithium begat beryllium. Does it work that way?
It's a similar, process.
Okay.
There are specific elements that get formed, and then in the explosion, other elements get formed that fill out the periodic table. That's one way to think about it. That's
okay.
Right.
So mm-hmm. each one births the next one, but only one, or does it ever birth more than one element?
There are processes that form multiple elements in the chain. So there are sometimes these chain collisions where, say, a helium will collide with another helium, and that'll form mm-hmm. an element. And then a helium will collide with that product to form two elements or something. There are these insanely complicated reaction charts that show all the different reactions between these different elements. It's typically just this process of forming hydrogen to helium, and then helium forms all sorts of elements. Once you have helium, helium can form lots of other things in the periodic table, assuming the star is big enough.
Then theoretically, there could be new elements that appear on the scene. I mean, we won't be around to see it, but theoretically, maybe after a certain number of billion years, there'd be a whole new line of elements?
Potentially. I mean, the one thing that's stopping the star from forming heavier and heavier elements
mm-hmm.
is this sort of roadblock that it hits once it starts trying to fuse iron together. And the reason why there's this roadblock is because all the other fusions of elements before you get to iron actually produce energy once you collide these things together. And that energy is actually what powers the star and makes it hot. The issue with fusing iron together is it actually takes energy to fuse
mm-hmm.
iron.
Mm-hmm.
So once you get to iron and start trying to fuse iron with iron, you actually require more energy than you put out, and that causes the star to enter the supernova explosion. So there is a stopping point. So we can't fuse, unlimited heavy elements. But there is thought that there are heavy elements that are produced in these supernova explosions that are just hard to detect. It won't keep going forever, but there, there's a lot that these stars can produce. That's correct.
But if iron is sort of a natural roadblock, how are there things on the periodic table that are higher than iron? I mean,
mostly from these supernova explosions. So you have lots of in the explosion, you have lots of free, what are called neutrons.
Mm-hmm.
And these heavy elements can capture these neutrons and move up the periodic table. So it's a slightly different process than fusion. Just a result of these explosions that leads to these heavier elements.
Okay. Well, I know I got far off a field with the periodic table, so
that's okay. I'm glad you're interested.
Well, let's come back to your research. So when you're looking at these, I'll call them like proto-stars and proto-galaxies, what is it that you hope to... what question are you trying to answer?
I think specifically, what were the first stars and galaxies like? We have this pretty good picture of what galaxies are like now.
Mm-hmm.
With these big optical telescopes like the James Webb Space Telescope and even telescopes before then, we can look back a few billion years in the history of the universe and see what galaxies were like slightly earlier when they were forming lots of these stars. One way that my advisor likes to put it is we have a pretty good understanding of what the universe was like And now when it's in like its middle-aged phase,
mm-hmm.
And we have a pretty good understanding of what the universe was like whenever it was, say, a teenager or like a young adult.
Okay.
But we don't really have a good understanding of what the universe was like whenever it was, say, like a toddler.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever it was first interacting with its environment and sort of, I guess, forming these, whenever these galaxies were forming these stars and evolving and, going through those first important stages of life. So I think it's that question that really is most interesting to me is like, what were these galaxies like early on? Because we have a fairly good understanding of what they're like late in life, but we don't have the best understanding of what they were doing, fairly early on.
And then how can you be sure that the toddlers that you're seeing are really the toddlers and not just only as far as the telescope can see?
Yeah, it's a great question. There's some issues that we try to deal with to make sure that what we're seeing is what we're actually is actually these stars and galaxies.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the majority of my PhD project is making sure that our instrument isn't corrupting our view of what we're actually observing.
Mm.
So there's a lot of work that goes into confirming that what we see is actually what we're seeing.
Okay.
And I guess to be clear, we haven't actually observed this yet. This is an ongoing project, but we're hoping to very soon. I think that's essentially just the work of lots of very intelligent students and professors is trying to understand that what we're actually observing is truly the signal we're trying to measure.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say, have there been times in the past where people have been, misled into thinking that they were seeing the edges of the universe and then, oh, yeah, it just keeps going?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think we have a pretty good sense of what the edge is at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the most common and I think best observed phenomenon that we have in astronomy, or I guess in cosmology, is what's called the cosmic microwave background.
Okay.
And it, I guess, represents the furthest thing that we can see in the universe just using light. And I guess what it represents is this warm afterglow of the Big Bang. So after the Big Bang, after the universe expanded and was hot for a while, it eventually reached a point where it cooled down enough where light could be freely emitted into the universe.
Uh-huh.
So we have a pretty good sense of I guess how far out we can actually see. What we're observing is in fact actually a little closer than that. But there have been times that people have thought that what they've observed was something, but actually ended up being something else. One example I can think that is fairly close to our field is observations of some of these really early galaxies.
Mm-hmm.
With the James Webb Space Telescope. There were astronomers who were observing these galaxies and had thought that they had measured an extremely massive galaxy that was had formed only a billion years after the Big Bang or something like that. And it was so big that it actually challenged some of our assumptions of our models of how galaxies form
mm-hmm.
and how our universe operates as a whole. And it turned out that galaxy ended up just being something that was closer to us.
Okay.
So it wasn't something that actually had formed a billion years after the Big Bang. It was something that we'd observed that was actually far closer. So it is true that you need to be very, very careful in confirming these detections. Yeah.
Okay. So we only have a few minutes left. So I want to find out how do people find out about the research that you're doing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the best way to look for future research that we're working on is by searching HERA. So the Hydrogen Epoch of Reionization Array is the name of our experiment.
Say that again.
It is the Hydrogen Epoch of Reionization Array.
And okay.
We abbreviate that as HERA.
Okay.
HERA. Yeah.
All right.
A little bit of a mouthful.
Okay.
But it's an experiment that we are currently working on. It is almost entirely built out. It's an array of radio telescopes that's in South Africa, whose goal is going to be to detect these early stars and galaxies.
Wow.
So if you want to follow along, we're releasing results every couple of years, and we're hoping to have something really exciting here in the near future. with our newest data set.
Okay. And then this is a totally random question. Growing up, did you have a favorite astronomy book? Or conversely, is there an astronomy book you would recommend for someone whose child is showing an interest in astronomy?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, the one that I love is Cosmos, written by Carl Sagan. It was one of my dad's favorite books, and I actually just recently got a illustrated copy from a thrift shop, and I was very excited about it. But if you're interested in learning more about astronomy, it's a very, very accessible way to learn about astronomy. Carl Sagan has a great way of writing that I think inspires you to think more deeply about the universe. One that's a little more, I think, advanced is A Brief History of Time. By Stephen Hawking. Both of those books are great for getting into astronomy and learning more about the universe, I think.
All right. Well, Tyler Cox, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. I wanted to study astronomy as a kid myself, and then, you know, got sidetracked in life. So I'm glad that there's someone out there who had that singular vision and stuck it out. And now you're finding out amazing things about the universe. So thank you so much for being on the show today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right, people of Earth. Yes, we are on Earth. And you can find out all about astronomy and all the things that Tyler was talking about. And you can go get the books that he mentioned. And you can just enjoy it, okay? And let's listen to some space music.
Take a seat, enjoy the ride. Past the clouds, yeah, we're past the sky. Trip to outer space. A trip to outer space. We got eight planets, let's start with the first one. Mercury is the closest one to the sun. About this planet we should learn more. Its interior is dominated by a large iron core. Now there's something that it can't conceal. Mercury has a small magnetic field, and I'm sure that there's more to this. But let's head to Venus, it's number two on our list. And I bet you didn't know, but it's true. It's the brightest in the sky except for the sun and the moon. Now the Earth is planet number three. The trees provide the oxygen that we need to breathe. Now here's some knowledge that I have to offer. 71% of Earth is made of water. Now this trip doesn't end, we're going past the stars. So what's planet number four? Mars. So now that you know that, here's more that you should know. It was formed about 4 billion years ago. And the rust in the soil makes it a red planet. Before we see the rest, here's a message from your captain. Take a seat, enjoy the ride. Clouds, yeah, we're past the sky. Trip to outer space. A trip to outer space. Take a seat, enjoy the ride. Past the clouds, yeah, we're past the sky. Trip to outer space. A trip to outer space.
Let's zoom past four. And Jupiter was what's in store. The giant of the solar system. And it's more than 300 times the mass of Earth. Then Saturn comes next in the verse. Did you know it had 18 moons? At least 18 moons. And last to be seen with a telescope zoom. But seventh from the sun is Uranus. Another gas giant with 27 moons that keep flying. And Neptune finally last of the gas. Giant several times larger than the Earth's mass. Can you imagine a quarter of your life left in pure darkness, living in the night? Well, that's how Neptune runs, and all eight planets revolve around the sun. So it's Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune. And Pluto is no longer a planet. There were two resolutions passed to revoke its status as a dwarf. It will always be in the mix, but it got voted out in August of 06.
Take a seat, enjoy the ride. Past the clouds, yeah, we're past the sky. Trip to outer space. A trip to outer space. Take a seat, enjoy the ride. Past the clouds, yeah, we're past the sky. Trip to outer space. A trip to outer space.
Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune. Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune.
Ooh, that was a Northrock 360 and Trip to Outer Space. That is from Brain Beats Volume 2. You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco, and you're in for a treat because, yeah, Silent Film Festival is here again. I love me some silent film. And here to talk about it is the fabulous Anita Monga. Hi.
Hello, the fabulous Marilyn.
How's it going?
Good. How are you?
I'm fine. It's like she's here in the studio like a real person. That's like we're in the aftertimes, I think.
We're in the analog moment.
I think so. It's pretty crazy. So, Anita, tell me what numbers silent film is this?
This is our 26th festival.
Okay.
And we're kind of off of our regular schedule because of the uncertainty with venue, but are back in the Castro.
Okay.
And so July 12 through 16. You know, 23 programs.
Ooh.
From all different countries, all different musicians. We're really excited.
So, what's the theme this year?
The theme is just like excellence.
Isn't the theme always excellence,
the
Anita?
The theme is always excellence. So we like to show superb music.
Mm-hmm.
We like to show superb,
uh-huh.
superb films and
magnificent
music.
So. Now, for our listening audience who doesn't know that, they have live musicians accompanying the silent film.
Yeah.
And is that how they used to do it back in when silent film was around?
Yes, indeed. There was never a time when a theater showed a film without music in it. So, you know, the audience for silent films in the silent era would always see something accompanied by music. And in the big, fancy theaters,
mm-hmm.
it was often like a full orchestra, like a Broadway play would be accompanied by an orchestra. So silent films were accompanied by orchestras in the fancy places, and in the less fancy places, on a piano, or then the Mighty Wurlitzer mm-hmm. came into being.
Ah, so. Yes. The thing they gave away on Let's Make a Deal all the time.
Exactly.
That I so wanted as a child. When they were doing silent films, was it ever the case where the people who made the film sort of gave direction as to what musical
sometimes.
Pieces they wanted?
Yeah, definitely, sometimes.
Okay.
And in fact, sometimes like artists like Charles Chaplin would actually compose music for his films. In fact, it is not possible to show a film, a Charles Chaplin feature,
mm-hmm.
without using his music.
Wow. So, was that part of the agreement?
It's part of the
or?
You know, people do it,
mm-hmm.
but it is, if you want to be on the up and up with the Chaplin estate,
mm-hmm.
yes, you always use his music.
That's
so we recently did a thing at the Paramount in Oakland with Chaplin City Lights with an orchestra.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, we were talking all about the music, and I'm completely not even focusing on the films that are coming. What's coming up?
Well, we're opening with a very exciting swashbuckling film with Douglas. It was Douglas Fairbanks' last silent film, and for people who've never seen Douglas Fairbanks, he's quite something. Completely charismatic. He did all his own stunts.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, Brad Pitt he has created his character after Douglas Fairbanks, that character in Babylon.
Uh-huh.
And also Michael Jean Dujardin in The Artist was after Douglas Fairbanks. So he's really, people fall in love with Douglas Fairbanks, and I really recommend it. And that's going to be with the Günter Buchwald
uh-huh.
ensemble. And
is that the Iron Mask?
That's the Iron Mask. I should say the name, shouldn't I? Yes, that's opening night, the Iron Mask. And it's really, really fun, beautiful.
Okay. Now, I see what's up in Mabel's room.
up in Mabel's room is really this very, I call it a little bonbon,
mm-hmm.
Tied up in a jazzy bow.
Okay.
It's a kind of bedroom forest. It's a very again, it's not a deep movie at all, but it's extremely fun. And and Gunter Buchwald, in fact, put together this very jazzy score for it, and it's really fun.
Okay.
So that's on Friday night up in Mabel's room. And that also, I should mention, we did three restorations. The San Francisco Silent Film Festival restored three films, including The Dragon Painter, which is going to be on Friday night. So The Dragon Painter stars Sessue Hayakawa, and he was a major star, like the first Asian star to become a matinee idol.
Okay. He's really handsome, right?
Really handsome. And really, you know, he became a star in Cecil B. DeMille's The Cheat in 1915, where he plays a kind of villain, kind of seductive villain.
Did you show that at the
we
last
did
year?
In, I think, in the A Day of Silence. And so he, you know, this is his own production. He developed his own production company because the parts he was getting in Hollywood were pretty
racist
and very boxed in. So he was, again, he created his own production company. And this film, Dragon Painter, is a kind of a fable about a painter who lives in the wild, who is brought into the master's court and falls in love with the master's daughter, played by Hayakawa's own wife. Anyway, major parts of it were filmed in Yosemite Valley. So Yosemite Valley in 1919. It's breathtaking.
And what night is that?
It's Friday night.
Okay.
So, yeah.
All right.
And there was a restoration of that title in 1988. This is we found additional material on it, and it's really, it makes a lot of difference, especially in one of the characters. But it's extremely beautiful restoration. The restoration that happened in 1988 was accompanied on the DVD by Mark Izu, who's a local musician who we went to and asked to accompany this time.
Okay.
And he's not able to this time, but he recommended a friend of his, a musician who lives in New York, Masaru Koga, who is going to accompany, and he created an ensemble. So he played saxophone and wonderful Japanese woodwind instruments. And so,
you don't think of those two together.
Well, they're actually like wood. And I don't know even if I'm saying the right kind of instrument, but I guess they're not wood reeds. They're actual wooden, they're lutes and flutes, that kind of instrument. So, and he will have with him percussion and piano and flute. And so that I'm really looking forward to that one.
Well, I couldn't help but notice you've got a title here called Pigs Will Be Pigs.
Pigs Will Be Pigs. Pigs Will Be Pigs is a Ukrainian film.
Okay.
And it was, it's kind of unusual for a Soviet, nobody thinks of Soviet titles as being funny. And this is a
comedy.
Really a raucously comic film, and also poking fun at the powers that be in the Soviet Union at the time. So this is from the Ukrainian archive in Kyiv. And, you know, we've been working with them for years, but we felt particularly we want to represent Ukraine, which was a really vital part of filmmaking in the 20s and 30s.
And weren't you, wasn't your organization trying to make sure to protect their film archive because they were being bombed at the time?
Yes. And, you know, there was a global effort to help the Ukrainian archive. And, you know, things are hard in Ukraine.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is particularly interesting. And this film was discovered by Peter Bagroff, who runs the George Eastman Museum, and he, you know, repatriated it to Ukraine, scanned it, repatriated it to Ukraine. So a couple years ago.
And that's happening on
Saturday at 3 o'clock.
Okay.
And followed by one of the most amazingly beautiful French films called Crankaby, that's based on an Anatole France story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's gorgeous. And that's going to be Stephen Horn is going to accompany with English horn, and he plays flute and piano. And then he's bringing in an ensemble, and so it'll be English horn and oboe,
okay,
and percussion. So
excellent. And then I couldn't help but notice the Edward E. Horton show, and I think when I think of Edward E. Horton, I think of Fractured Fairy Tales and all those things from the Rocky and Bullwinkle.
Right. And also in, you know, with Fred Astaire, and, you know, we always played these very arch. And anyone who's ever seen or heard Edward E. Horton thinks of his voice. He has a very distinctive voice.
Yes.
And so it's so interesting to see these silent films. And they were produced by Harold Lloyd. But Edward E. Horton was hilarious from the beginning, even without the voice.
Uh-huh. So for our listening audience, when does the Silent Film Festival start, and how long does it run?
Wednesday, July 12th, and it runs to Sunday, July 16th.
And how would people go about getting tickets?
At www.silentfilm.org.
Okay. And if people want to know what the thinkings are about what films you guys are restoring and things like that, how would they find out that?
Oh, I guess they would have to call me. Everyone can reach us through our silentfilm.org. There are ways to reach us. But
right.
Yeah.
Well, Anita Monga, I'm so glad that that you guys got a venue close to my house so I can go and see it. And so, because
it's at the Castro.
And I'm thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you, Marilyn.
All right.
Happy 4th.
Happy 4th to you. And people of Earth, Silent Film, it's awesome. When I went through a particularly bad patch a long time ago, and all I did was go to the library and check out silent films. My friends thought they were going to have to do an intervention, but they didn't, because Silent Film took care of it, and it can take care of you as well. It's just about time for me to turn the mic over to Mr. Ford. So until next week, my friends, ta-ta and toodly-doo.